Maybe,
agreed Jill.
Mike, I'm falling asleep. Pop me into bed, please.
She was lifted, wafted into the bedroom. Covers rolled themselves back. She slept. Jill woke at 7, slipped out of bed, put her head into the other room. Lights were out and shades were tight, but they were not asleep. Jill heard Mike say with soft certainty, "Thou art God."
"Thou art God,"
Patricia whispered, in a voice as heavy as if drugged. "Yes, Jill is God."
"Jill is God, yes, Michael."
"And thou art God."
"Thou art God, now, Michael, now."
Jill went quietly away and brushed her teeth. Presently she let Mike know that she was awake, and found that he knew it. When she came back into the living room, sunlight was streaming in.
"Good morning, darlings."
She kissed them.
"Thou art God,"
Patty said simply.
"Yes, Patty. And thou art God. God is in all of us."
She looked at Patty in the harsh morning light and noted that she did not look tired. Well, she knew that effect. If Mike wanted her to stay up all night, Jill never found it any trouble. She suspected that her sleepiness the night before had been Mike's idea, and heard Mike agree in his mind.
"Now coffee, darlings, and I happen to have stashed away a ready pack of orange juice, too."
They breakfasted lightly, replete with happiness. Jill saw Patty looking thoughtful.
"What is it, dear?"
I hate to mention this, but what are you kids going to eat on? Aunt Patty has a pretty well-stuffed grouch bag, and I thought..."
Jill laughed.
"Oh, darling,
I shouldn't laugh.
But the man from Mars is rich. Surely you know."
Mrs. Piwanski looked baffled.
"Well, I guess I knew, but you can't trust anything you hear over the news.
Patty, you're another darling. Believe me, now that we're water brothers, we wouldn't hesitate. Sharing the nest isn't just poetry. But it's the other way around. If you ever need money, just say so. Any amount, any time. Write us. Better yet, call me. Mike doesn't have the foggiest idea about money.
Why, dear, I'm keeping a couple of hundred thousand in my name right now.
Want some?"
Mrs. Piwanski looked startled.
"Bless me, I don't need money."
Jill shrugged.
"If you ever do, just holler. If you want a yacht, Mike would enjoy giving you a yacht."
"I certainly would, Pat. I've never seen a yacht." Mrs. Piwanski shook her head.
"Don't take me up on a tall mountain, dearie. All I want from you two is your love."
"You have that," Jill told her.
"I don't grok love," Mike said. "But Jill always speaks rightly. If we've got it, it's yours."
"And to know that you're saved. But I'm no longer worried about that. Mike has told me about waiting and why waiting is. You understand, Jill?"
"I grok. I'm no longer impatient about anything."
"But I have something for you too."
The tattooed lady got her purse, took a book out.
"My dear ones, this is the very copy of the new revelation that Blessed Foster gave me, the night he placed his kiss on me. I want you to have it."
Jill's eyes filled with tears.
"But, Aunt Patty, Patty, our brother, we can't take this one. We'll buy one."
"No, it's water I'm sharing with you for growing closer."
"Oh."
Jill jumped up.
"We'll share it. It's ours now. All of us."
She kissed her. Mike tapped her shoulder. "Greedy little brother. My turn."
"I'll always be greedy that way."
The man from Mars kissed his new brother, first on her mouth, then kissed the spot Foster had kissed. He pondered, briefly by Earth time, picked a corresponding spot on the other side where George's design could be matched, kissed her there, while he thought by stretched out time and in great detail. It was necessary to grok the capillaries. To the other two, he briefly pressed his lips to skin, but Jill caught a hint of his effort.
"Patty, see."
Mrs. Piwanski looked down. Marked on her, paired stigmata in blood red, were his lips. She started to faint, then showed her staunch faith.
"Yes, yes, Michael."
Shortly, the tattooed lady was replaced by a mousy housewife in high neck, long sleeves, and gloves.
"I won't cry," she said soberly. "And there are no goodbyes in eternity. I will be waiting."
She kissed them, left without looking back. Chapter 28.
Blasphemy!
Foster looked up. Something bite you, Junior? This annex had been run up in a hurry, and things did get in, swarms of almost invisible imps, usually, harmless, but a bite from one left an itch on the ego.
You'd have to see it to believe it. Here, I'll run the omniscio back a touch.
You'd be surprised at what I can believe, Junior. Nevertheless, Digby's supervisor shifted part of his attention. Three temporals. Humans, he saw they were. A man and two women, speculating about the eternal. Nothing odd about that.
Yes? You heard what she said? Archangel Michael, indeed.
What about it?
What about it? Oh, for God's sake!
Very possibly. Digby's halo quivered.
Foster, you must not have taken a good look. She meant that overage juvenile delinquent that sent me to the showers. Scan it again.
Foster let the gain increase, noted that the angel in training had spoken rightly, and noticed something else, and smiled his angelic smile.
How do you know he isn't, Junior?
Huh?
I haven't seen Mike around the club lately, and his name has been scratched on the Millennial Solipsist Tournament. That's a sign that he's likely away on detached duty. Mike is one of the most eager solipsism players in this sector.
But the notion's obscene.
You'd be surprised how many of the boss's best ideas have been called obscene in some quarters. Or rather, you should not be surprised in view of your field work. But obscene is a null concept. It has no theological meaning. To the pure, all things are pure.
But
I'm still witnessing, Junior. In addition to the fact that our brother Michael seems to be away at this micro-instant, I don't keep track of him. We're not on the same watch list. That tattooed lady who made that oracular pronouncement is not likely to be mistaken. She's a very holy temporal herself.
Who says?
I say. I know. Foster smiled again with angelic sweetness. Dear little Patricia, getting a little long in the tooth, but still earthily desirable, and shining with an inner light that made her look like a stained glass window. He noted, without temporal pride, that George had finished his great dedication since he had last looked at Patricia. That picture of his being called up to heaven wasn't bad. Not bad at all, in the higher sense. He must remember to look up George and compliment him on it, and tell him he had seen Patricia. Where was George? A creative artist in the universe design section, working right under the architect, as he recalled. No matter. The master file would dig him out in a split millennium. What a delicious little butterball Patricia had been, and such holy frenzy! If she had had just a touch more assertiveness and a touch less humility, he could have made her a priestess. But such was Patricia's need to accept God according to her own nature, that she could have qualified only among the Lingayats, where she wasn't needed. Foster considered scanning back and seeing her as she had been. Decided against it with angelic restraint. There was work to be done.
Forget the omniscio, Junior. I want a word with you.
Digby did so and waited. Foster twanged his halo, an annoying habit he had when he was meditating.
Junior, you aren't shaping up too angelically.
I'm sorry.
Sorry is not for eternity. But the truth is, you've been preoccupied with that young fellow who may or may not be our brother Michael. Now wait. In the first place, it is not for you to judge the instrument used to call you from the pasture. In the second place, it is not he who vexes you. You hardly knew him. What's bothering you is that little brunette secretary you had. She had earned my kiss quite some temporal period before you were called, hadn't she?
I was still testing her.
Then no doubt you have been angelically pleased to note that Supreme Bishop Short, after giving her a thorough examination himself, oh, most thorough, I told you he would measure up, has passed her, and she now enjoys the wider happiness she deserves. A shepherd should take joy in his work. But when he's promoted, he should joy in that, too. Now it happens there is a spot open for a guardian in training in a new sector being opened up. A job under your nominal rank, I concede, but good angelic experience. This planet, well, you think of it as a planet, you'll see, is occupied by a race of tripolarity instead of bipolarity,
and I have it on high authority that Don Juan himself could not manage to take earthly interest in any of their three polarities. That's not opinion. He was borrowed as a test. He screamed and prayed to be returned to the solitary hell he has created for himself.
Going to send me to Flatbush, huh? So I won't interfere.
Tut, tut, you can't interfere. The one impossibility that permits all else to be possible. I tried to tell you that when you arrived. But don't let it fret you. You are eternally permitted to try. Your orders will include a loop so that you will check back here now without loss of temporality. Now fly away and get cracking. I have work to do.
Foster turned back to where he had been interrupted.
Oh, yes, a poor soul temporarily designated as Alice Douglas. To be a goad was a hard assignment, and she had met it unflaggingly. But her job was complete, and now she would need rest and rehabilitation from the inescapable battle fatigue. She'd be kicking and screaming and foaming ectoplasm at all orifices. Oh, she would need exorcism after a job that rough. But they were all rough. They couldn't be anything else. And Alice Douglas was an utterly reliable field operative. She could take any left-hand assignment, as long as it was essentially virginal. Burn her at the stake, or put her in a nunnery, she always delivered. Not that he cared much for virgins, other than with professional respect for any job well done. Foster sneaked a last look at Mrs. Pywanski. There was a fellow worker he could appreciate. Darling little Patricia, what a blessed, lusty benison.
Chapter 29. As the door closed behind Patricia, Jill said,
"What now, Mike?"
"We're leaving."
"Jill, you've read some abnormal psychology."
"Yes, not as much as you have."
"You know the symbolism of tattooing? And snakes?"
"Of course, I knew that about Patty as soon as I met her. I had been hoping that you would find a way."
"I couldn't until we were water brothers. Sex is a helpful goodness, but only if it is sharing and growing closer. I grok that if I did it without growing closer, well, I'm not sure."
"I grok you couldn't, Mike. That is one reason, one of the many reasons, I love you."
"I still don't grok love."
"Jill, I don't grok people."
"But I didn't want Pat to leave."
"Stop her. Keep her with us."
"Waiting is, Jill. I know."
He added,
"I doubt if we could give her all she needs. She wants to give herself all the time, to everybody. Happiness meetings and snakes and marks aren't enough for Pat. She wants to offer herself on an altar to everybody in the world, always, and make them happy."
This new revelation, I grok it is other things to other people, but that is what it is to Pat.
"Yes, Mike. Dear Mike."
"Time to leave. Pick a dress and get your purse. I'll dispose of the trash."
Jill thought wistfully that she would like to take one or two things. Mike always moved on with just the clothes on his back, and seemed to grok that she preferred it that way.
"I'll wear that pretty blue one."
It floated out, posed over her, wriggled on to her as she held up her hands. The zipper closed. Shoes walked toward her. She stepped into them.
"I'm ready."
Mike had caught the flavor of her thought, but not the concept. It was too alien to Martian ideas.
"Jill, do you want to stop and get married?"
She thought about it.
"It's Sunday. We couldn't get a license."
"Tomorrow, then. I grok you would like it."
"No, Mike."
"Why not, Jill?"
"We wouldn't be any closer. We already share water. That's true both in English and Martian."
"Yes."
"And a reason just in English. I wouldn't have Dorcas and Anne and Miriam and Patty think that I was trying to crowd them out."
"Jill, none of them would think so."
"I won't chance it because I don't need it. Because you married me in a hospital room ages and ages ago."
She hesitated.
"But there is something you might do for me."
"What, Jill?"
"Well, you might call me pet names, the way I do you."
"Yes, Jill. What pet names?"
"Oh."
She kissed him quickly.
"Mike, you're the sweetest, most lovable man I've ever met, and the most infuriating creature on two planets. Don't bother, just call me little brother occasionally. It makes me all quivery inside."
"Yes, little brother."
"Oh, my, let's get out of here before I take you back to bed." Meet me downstairs. I'll be paying the bill.
She left suddenly. They caught the first greyhound going anywhere.
A week later, they stopped at home, shared water for a few days, left without saying goodbye. Goodbye was one human custom Mike resisted. He used it only with strangers.
Shortly, they were in Las Vegas, stopping in a hotel off the strip. Mike tried the games while Jill killed time as a showgirl. She couldn't sing or dance. Parading in a tall, improbable hat, a smile, and a scrap of tinsel was the job suited to her in the Babylon of the West. She preferred to work if Mike was busy. And somehow, Mike always got her the job she picked. Since casinos never closed, Mike was busy almost all the time. Mike was careful not to win much, keeping to limits Jill set. After he had milked each casino for a few thousand, he put it all back, never letting himself be the big money player. Then he took a job as a croupier, letting the little ball roll without interference, and studying people, trying to grok why they gambled. He grokked a drive that felt intensely sexual. But he seemed to grok wrongness in this. Jill assumed that the customers in the palatial theater restaurant where she worked were just marks, and as such did not count. But to her surprise, she actively enjoyed displaying herself in front of them. With increasing Martian honesty, she examined this feeling. She had always enjoyed being looked at with admiration by men whom she found attractive enough to want to touch. She had been irked that the sight of her body meant nothing to Mike, even though he was as devoted to her body as a woman could dream of. If he wasn't preoccupied. But he was generous even then. He would let her call him out of a trance, shift gears without complaint, and be smiling and eager and loving. Nevertheless, there it was. One of his strangenesses, like his inability to laugh. Jill decided, after her initiation as a showgirl, that she enjoyed being visually admired by strangers, because this was the one thing Mike did not give her. Her perfecting self-honesty soon washed out that theory. The men in the audience were mostly too old, too fat, too bald for Jill to find them attractive. And Jill had always been scornful of lecherous old wolves, although not of old men, she reminded herself. Jubal could look at her, even use crude language, and not give her any feeling that he wanted to get her alone and grope her. But now she found that these lecherous old wolves did not set her teeth on edge. When she felt their admiring stares or outright lust, and she did feel it, could identify the sources, she did not resent it. It warmed her, and made her smugly pleased. Exhibitionism had been to her just a technical term, a weakness she held in contempt. Now, in digging out her own and looking at it, she decided that either this form of narcissism was normal or she was abnormal. But she didn't feel abnormal. She felt healthier than ever. She had always been of rugged health, nurses need to be. But she hadn't had a sniffle or an upset stomach in... she couldn't remember when. Why, not even cramps. Okay, if a healthy woman liked to be looked at, then it follows, as the night the day, that healthy men should like to look, else there was just no darn sense to it. At which point, she finally understood, intellectually, Duke and his pictures. She discussed it with Mike, but Mike could not understand why Jill had ever minded being looked at. He understood not wishing to be touched. Mike avoided shaking hands. He wanted to be touched only by Water Brothers. Jill wasn't sure how far this went. She had explained homosexuality after Mike had read about it and failed to grok, and had given him rules for avoiding passes. She knew that Mike, pretty as he was, would attract such. He had followed her advice and had made his face more masculine, instead of the androgynous beauty he had had. But Jill was not sure that Mike would refuse a pass, say, from Duke. Fortunately, Mike's male Water Brothers were decidedly masculine, just as his others were very female women. Jill suspected that Mike would grok a wrongness in the poor in-betweeners anyhow. They would never be offered water. Nor could Mike understand why it now pleased her to be stared at. The only time their attitudes had been roughly similar had been as they left the carnival, when Jill had become indifferent to stares. She saw now that her present self-knowledge had been nascent then. She had not been truly indifferent to masculine stares. Under the stresses of adjusting to the man from Mars, she had shucked off part of her cultural conditioning, that degree of prissiness a nurse can retain despite a no-nonsense profession. But Jill hadn't known that she had any prissiness until she lost it. At last, she was able to admit to herself
that there was something inside her as happily shameless as a tabby in heat. She tried to explain this to Mike, giving her theory of the complementary functions of narcissist display and voyeurism. "The truth is, Mike, I get a kick out of having men stare at me. Lots of men, and almost any man. So now I grok why Duke likes pictures of women. The sexier, the better. It doesn't mean that I want to go to bed with them, any more than Duke wants to go to bed with a photograph. But when they look at me and tell me, think at me, that I'm desirable, it gives me a warm tingle right in my middle." She frowned slightly. "I ought to get a real naughty picture taken of me and send it to Duke, to tell him I'm sorry I failed to grok what I thought was a weakness in him. If it's a weakness, I've got it too, girl style. If it is a weakness, I grok it isn't."
"All right, we'll find a photographer."
She shook her head. "I'll apologize instead. I won't send such a picture. Duke has never made a pass at me, and I don't want him getting ideas."
"Jill, you would not want Duke?"
She heard an echo of Water Brother in his mind. I've never thought about it. I guess I've been being faithful to you. But I grok you speak rightly. I wouldn't turn Duke down. And I would enjoy it, too. What do you think of that, darling?"
"I grok a goodness," Mike said seriously.
"My gallant Martian, there are times when human females appreciate a semblance of jealousy. But I don't think there is any chance that you will ever grok jealousy. Darling, what would you grok if one of those marks made a pass at me?"
Mike barely smiled. "I grok he would be missing."
"I grok he might. But, Mike, listen, dear, you promised you wouldn't do anything of that sort except in utter emergency. If you hear me scream and reach into my mind and I'm in real trouble, that's another matter. But I was coping with wolves when you were still on Mars. 9 times out of 10, if a girl gets raped, it's partly her fault, so don't be hasty."
"I will remember. I wish you were sending that naughty picture to Duke."
"What, dear?" "If I make a pass at Duke, and I may, now that you put the idea in my head, I'd rather grab his shoulders and say, 'Duke, how about it? I'm willing. I don't want to do it by sending him a picture, like those nasty women used to send to you. But if you want me to, okay.'"
Mike frowned. "If you wish to send Duke a naughty picture, do so. If you not wish, then not. But I had hoped to see the naughty picture taken." "Jill, what is a naughty picture?"
Mike was baffled by Jill's reversal in attitude, plus long-standing bafflement at Duke's art collection. But the pale Martian thing which parallels tumultuous human sexuality gave him no foundation for grokking either narcissism or voyeurism, modesty or display. He added,
"Naughty means a small wrongness, but I grok you did not mean a wrongness, but a goodness."
"A naughty picture could be either, I guess, depending on who it's for, now that I'm over my prejudice. But, Mike, I'll have to show you. I can't tell you. Close those slats, will you?"
Venetian blinds flipped themselves shut.
"All right," she said. "This pose is just a little naughty. Any showgirl would use it as a professional pick. And this is a bit more so. Some girls would use it. But this is unmistakably naughty. And this one is quite naughty. And this is so extremely naughty that I wouldn't pose with my face wrapped in a towel, unless you wanted it."
"If your face was covered, why would I want it?"
"Ask Duke, that's all I can say."
"I grok not wrongness. I grok not goodness. I grok..."
He used a Martian word, indicating a null state of all emotions. Because he was baffled, they went on discussing it, in Martian when possible because of its extremely fine discriminations for emotions and values, and in English because Martian couldn't cope with the concepts. To pursue this mystery, Mike took a ringside table that night, Jill having coached him in how to bribe the maître d'hôtel. Jill came strutting out in the first number, her smile for everyone, but a wink for Mike. She discovered that with Mike present, the warm, pleased sensation she had been enjoying nightly was greatly amplified. She suspected that she would glow in the dark. When the girls formed a tableau, Mike was about 10 feet from Jill. She had been promoted to a front position. The director had shifted her on the fourth day, saying,
I don't know what it is, kid. We've got girls with twice your build. But you've got what customers look at.
She posed and talked with Mike in her mind.
Feel anything?
I grok, but not in fullness.
Look where I am looking, my brother. The small one. He quivers. He thirsts for me.
I grok his thirst.
Can you see him?
Jill stared into the customer's eyes, both to increase his interest and to let Mike use her eyes. As her grokking of Martian thought had increased, and as they had grown steadily closer, they had begun to use this common Martian convenience. Jill had little control as yet. Mike could see through her eyes simply by calling to her. She could see through his, only if he gave it his attention.
We grok him together, Mike agreed. Great thirst for little brother.
Yes, beautiful agony.
A music cue told Jill to resume her slow strut. She did so, moving with proud sensuousness and feeling lust boil up in response to emotions both from Mike and the stranger. The routine caused her to walk toward the ruddy little stranger. She continued to lock eyes with him. Something happened, which was totally unexpected to her because Mike had never explained that it was possible. She had been letting herself receive the stranger's emotions, teasing him with eyes and body, and relaying what she felt to Mike. When suddenly, she was seeing herself through strange eyes, and feeling all the primitive need with which that stranger saw her. She stumbled and would have fallen had not Mike caught her, lifted her, steadied her, until she could walk unassisted, second sight gone. The parade of beauties continued through the exit. Offstage, the girl behind her said,
"What happened, Jill?"
"Caught my heel."
"That was the wildest recover I ever saw. You looked like a puppet on strings."
"And so I was, dear.
I'm going to ask the stage manager to check that spot. I think there's a loose board."
For the rest of the show, Mike gave her glimpses of how she looked to various men, while making sure that she was not again taken by surprise. Jill was startled at how varied were the images. One noticed her legs. Another was fascinated by the undulations of her torso. A third saw only her proud bosom. Then Mike let her look at other girls in the tableau. She was relieved to find that Mike saw them as she did, but sharper. But she was amazed to find that her excitement increased as she looked through his eyes at other girls. Mike left during the finale ahead of the crowd. She did not expect to see him again that night, since he had asked for time off only to see her show. But when she returned to their hotel, she felt him before she reached the room. The door opened, closed behind her.
"Hello, darling," she called out. "How nice you came home."
He smiled gently.
"I now grok naughty pictures."
Her clothes vanished.
"Make naughty pictures."
"Huh?"
"Yes, dear, of course."
She ran through poses as she had earlier. With each one, Mike let her use his eyes to see herself. She looked and felt his emotions, and felt her own swell and mutually amplified re-echoing. At last, she placed herself in a pose as randy as her imagination could devise.
"Naughty pictures are a great goodness," Mike said gravely.
"Yes, and now I grok them too.
What are you waiting for?"
They quit their jobs and saw every review on the strip. Jill found that she grokked naughty pictures only through a man's eyes. If Mike watched, she shared his mood from sensuous pleasure to full rut. But if Mike's attention wandered, the model, dancer, or peeler was just another woman. She decided that this was fortunate. To have discovered in herself lesbian tendencies would have been too much. But it was fun. Great goodness to see girls through his eyes, and ecstatic goodness to know that, at last, he looked at her the same way. They moved on to Palo Alto, where Mike tried to swallow the Hoover Library. But scanners could not spin that fast, nor could Mike turn pages fast enough to read them all. At last he admitted that he was taking in data faster than he could grok it, even spending all hours the library was closed in contemplation. With relief, Jill moved them to San Francisco, and he embarked on systematic research. She came back to their flat one day to find him doing nothing, surrounded by books, many books, the Talmud, the Kama Sutra, Bibles in several versions, the Book of the Dead, the Book of Mormon, Patty's precious copy of the New Revelation, various Apocrypha, the Koran, the unabridged Golden Bough, the Way, Science and Health, with key to the scriptures, sacred writings of a dozen other religions, major and minor, even such oddities as Crowley's Book of the Law.
Trouble, dear?
Jill, I don't grok.
Waiting, Michael. Waiting for fullness is.
I don't think waiting will fill it. I know what's wrong. I'm not a man, I'm a Martian. A Martian in a body of the wrong shape.
You're plenty of man for me, dear. And I love the way your body is shaped.
Oh, you grok what I'm talking about. I don't grok people. I don't understand this multiplicity of religions. Now, among my people...
Your people, Mike?
Sorry, I should have said that among Martians there is only one religion. And it is not a faith, it's a certainty. You grok it, thou art God.
Yes, she agreed. I do grok, in Martian. But, dearest, it doesn't say the same thing in English. I don't know why.
On Mars, when we needed to know anything, we asked the old ones, and the answer was never wrong. Jill, is it possible that we humans don't have old ones? No souls, I mean. When we discorporate, die. We do die, dead. Die all over and nothing left. Do we live in ignorance because it doesn't matter? Because we are gone and not a rack behind in time so short that a Martian would use it for one long contemplation? Tell me, Jill. You're human.
She smiled with sober serenity. You yourself have told me. You have taught me to know eternity, and you can't take it away from me. You can't die, Mike. You can only discorporate.
She gestured at herself with both hands.
This body that you have taught me to see through your eyes, and that you have loved so well, someday it will be gone. But I shall not be gone. I am that I am. Thou art God, and I am God, and we are God eternally. I am not sure where I will be, or whether I will remember that I was once Jill Boardman, who was happy trotting bedpans, and equally happy strutting her stuff in the buff under bright lights. I have liked this body.
With a most uncustomary gesture of impatience, Mike threw away her clothes.
Thank you, dear, she said. It has been a nice body to me, and to you, to both of us who thought of it. But I don't expect to miss it when I'm through with it. I hope that you will eat it when I discorporate.
Oh, I'll eat you, all right. Unless I discorporate first.
I don't suppose you will. With your much greater control over your sweet body, I suspect that you can live several centuries at least, unless you choose to discorporate sooner.
I might, but not now. Jill, I've tried and tried.
How many churches have we attended? All the sorts in San Francisco, I think. I don't recall how many times we have been to Seeker's services.
That's just a comfort, Pat. I'd never go again if you weren't sure that she needs to know that we haven't given up.
She does need to. We can't lie. You don't know how, and I can't, not to Patty.
Actually, he admitted, the Fosterites have quite a lot, all twisted, of course. They are groping, the way I did as a carny. They'll never correct their mistakes, because this...
He caused Patty's book to lift.
Is mostly crap.
Yes, but Patty doesn't see those parts. She is wrapped in innocence. She is God, and behaves accordingly. Only she doesn't know she is.
Uh-huh, he agreed. That's our Pat. She believes it only when I tell her, with proper emphasis. But Jill, there are only three places to look. Science, and I was taught more about how the universe ticks while I was still in the nest than human scientists can yet handle. So much that I can't talk to them, even about as elementary a gimmick as levitation. I'm not disparaging scientists. What they do is as it should be. I grok that fully. But what they are after is not what I am looking for. You don't grok a desert by counting its grains of sand. Then there's philosophy, supposed to tackle everything, does it? All any philosopher ever comes out with is what he walked in with, except for self-deluders who prove their assumptions by their conclusions, like Kant, like other tail-chasers. So the answer ought to be here.
He waved at piles of books.
Only it's not. Bits that grok true, but never a pattern. Or if there is, they ask you to take the hard part on faith.
Faith? What a dirty monosyllable.
Jill, why didn't you mention that one when you were teaching me the short words that mustn't be used in polite company?
She smiled. Mike, you made a joke.
I didn't mean it as a joke. And I can't see that it's funny. Jill, I haven't even been good for you. You used to laugh. I haven't learned to laugh. Instead, you've forgotten. Instead of my becoming human, you're becoming Martian.
I'm happy, dear. You probably just haven't noticed me laughing.
If you laughed clear down on Market Street, I would hear. I grok. Once I quit being frightened by it, I always noticed it. You especially. If I grokked it, I would grok people, I think. Then I could help somebody like Pat, teach her what I know and learn what she knows. We could understand each other.
Mike, all you need to do for Patty is to see her occasionally. Why don't we, dear? Let's get out of this dreary fog. She's home now. The carny is closed for the season. Drop south and see her. And I've always wanted to see Baja California. We could go on south into warmer weather. And take her with us. That would be fun.
All right.
She stood up. Let me get a dress. Do you want to save those books? I could ship them to Jubal.
He flipped his fingers and all were gone, but Patricia's gift. We'll take that one. Pat would notice. But Jill, right now, I need to go to the zoo.
All right.
I want to spit back at a camel and ask him what he's sour about. Maybe camels are the old ones on this planet. And that's what's wrong with the place.
Two jokes in one day, Mike.
I ain't laughing. Neither are you, nor the camel. Maybe he groks why. Is this dress all right? Do you want underclothes?
Please, dear. It's chilly.
Up easy.
He levitated her a couple of feet.
Pants, stockings, garter belt, shoes. Down you go and lift your arms. Bra? You don't need one. Now the dress and you're decent. And pretty, whatever that is. You look good. Maybe I can get a job as lady's maid if I'm not good for anything else. Baths, shampoos, massages, hairstyling, makeup, dressing for all occasions. I've even learned to do your nails so it suits you. Will that be all, madame?
You're a perfect lady's maid, dear.
Yes, I grok I am.
You look so good I think I'll toss it away and give you a massage.
The growing closer kind.
Yes, Michael.
I thought you had learned waiting. First you have to take me to the zoo and buy me peanuts.
Yes, Mike.
It was windy cold at Golden Gate Park, but Mike did not notice, and Jill had learned how not to be cold. But it was pleasant to relax control in the warm monkey house. Aside from its heat, Jill did not like the monkey house. Monkeys and apes were depressingly human. She was, she thought, finished forever with prissiness. She had grown to cherish an ascetic, almost Martian joy in all things physical. The public copulations and evacuations of these simians did not offend her. These poor penned people possessed no privacy. They were not at fault. She could watch without repugnance, her own fastidiousness untouched. No, it was that they were human, all too human. Every action, every expression, every puzzled, troubled look reminded her of what she liked least about her own race. Jill preferred the lion house, the great males arrogant even in captivity, the placid motherliness of the big females, the lordly beauty of Bengal tigers with jungle staring out of their eyes, little leopards, swift and deadly, reek of musk that air conditioning could not purge. Mike shared her tastes. They would spend hours there, or in the aviary or the reptile house, or in watching seals. Once he told her that if one had to be hatched on this planet, to be a sea lion would be of greatest goodness. When he first saw a zoo, Mike was much upset. Jill was forced to order him to wait and grok, as he had been about to free the animals. He conceded presently that most of them could not live where he proposed to turn them loose. A zoo was a nest of a sort. He followed this with hours of withdrawal, after which he never again threatened to remove bars and glass and grills. He explained to Jill that bars were to keep people out more than to keep animals in, which he had failed to grok at first. After that, Mike never missed a zoo wherever they went. But today even the misanthropy of camels could not shake Mike's moodiness, nor did monkeys and apes cheer him up. They stood in front of a cage containing a family of Capuchins, watching them eat, sleep, court, nurse, groom, and swarm aimlessly around, while Jill tossed them peanuts. She tossed one to a monk. Before he could eat it, a larger male not only stole his peanut, but gave him a beating. The little fellow made no attempt to pursue his tormentor. He pounded his knucks against the floor and chattered helpless rage. Mike watched solemnly. Suddenly, the mistreated monkey rushed across the cage, picked a monkey still smaller, bowled it over, and gave it a drubbing worse than the one he had suffered. The third monk crawled away, whimpering. The other monkeys paid no attention. Mike threw back his head and laughed, and went on laughing uncontrollably. He gasped for breath, started to tremble and sink to the floor, still laughing. "Stop it, Mike!" He did cease folding up, but his guffaws went on. An attendant hurried over. "Lady, do you need help?" "Can you call us a cab, ground air, anything? I've got to get him out of here," she added. "He's not well."
"Ambulance? Looks like he's having a fit."
"Anything." A few minutes later, she led Mike into a piloted air cab. She gave their address, then said urgently, "Mike, listen to me. Quiet down." He became somewhat quiet, but continued to chuckle. Laugh aloud, chuckle again, while she wiped his eyes. All the minutes it took to get home. She got him inside, got his clothes off, made him lie down. "All right, dear. Withdraw if you need to."
"I'm all right. At last I'm all right."
"I hope so." She sighed. "You scared me, Mike."
"I'm sorry, little brother. I was scared, too, the first time I heard laughing."
"Mike, what happened?"
"Jill, I grok people."
"Huh?" "Hmm?"
"I speak rightly, little brother. I grok. I grok people now, Jill. Little brother, precious, darling, little imp with lively legs and lovely, lewd, lascivious, lecherous, licentious libido, beautiful bumps and pert posterior, soft voice and gentle hands, my baby darling."
"Why, Michael?"
"Oh, I knew the words. I simply didn't know when or why say them, nor why you wanted me to. I love you, sweetheart. I grok love now, too."
"You always have. And I love you, you smooth ape, my darling."
"Ape, yes. Come here, she-ape. Put your head on my shoulder and tell me a joke."
"Just tell you a joke?"
"Well, nothing more than snuggling."
"Tell me a joke I've never heard, and see if I laugh at the right place. I will, I'm sure of it. And I'll tell you why it's funny. Jill, I grok people."
"But how, darling? Can you tell me? Does it need Martian? Or mind talk?"
"No, that's the point. I grok people. I am people. So now I can say it in people talk. I found out why people laugh. They laugh because it hurts. Because it's the only thing that'll make it stop hurting."
Jill looked puzzled. "Maybe I'm the one who isn't people. I don't understand."
"Ah, but you are people, little she-ape. You grok it so automatically that you don't have to think about it, because you grew up with people. But I didn't. I've been like a puppy raised apart from dogs who couldn't be like his masters and had never learned how to be a dog, so I had to be taught. Brother Mahmud taught me, Jubal taught me, lots of people taught me. And you taught me most of all. Today I got my diploma, and I laughed. That poor little monk."
"Which one, dear? I thought that big one was just mean, and the one I flipped the peanut to turned out to be just as mean. There certainly wasn't anything funny."
"Jill, Jill, my darling, too much Martian has rubbed off on you. Of course it wasn't funny, it was tragic. That's why I had to laugh. I looked at a cage full of monkeys, and suddenly I saw all the mean and cruel and utterly unexplainable things I've seen and heard and read about in the time I've been with my own people, and suddenly it hurt so much, I found myself laughing."
"But, Mike, dear, laughing is what you do when something is nice, not when it's horrid."
"Is it? Think back to Las Vegas, when you girls came out on stage. Did people laugh?"
"Well, no."
but you girls were the nicest part of the show. I grok now that if they had laughed, you would have been hurt. No, they laughed when a comic tripped over his feet and fell down, or something else that is not a goodness. But that's not all people laugh at, isn't it? Perhaps I don't grok its fullness yet. But find me something that makes you laugh, sweetheart, a joke, anything, but something that gave you a belly laugh, not a smile. Then we'll see if there isn't a wrongness somewhere, and whether you would laugh if the wrongness wasn't there. He thought, I grok when apes learn to laugh. There'll be people. Maybe. Doubtfully but earnestly, Jill started digging into her memory for jokes that had struck her as irresistibly funny, ones which had jerked a laugh out of her. Her entire bridge club. Should I bow? Neither one, you idiot. Instead. The Chinaman objects. Broke her leg. Make trouble for me? But it'll spoil the ride for me. And his mother-in-law fainted. Stop you? I bet 3-1 you could do it. Something has happened to Oli. And so are you, you clumsy ox. She gave up on funny stories, pointing out that such were just fantasies, and tried to recall real incidents. Practical jokes. All practical jokes supported Mike's thesis, even ones as mild as a dribble glass. And when it came to an intern's notion of a joke, interns should be kept in cages. What else? The time Elsa May lost her panties? It hadn't been funny to Elsa May. Or the... She said grimly, apparently the pratfall is the peak of all humor. It's not a pretty picture of the human race, Mike. Oh, but it is. Huh? I had thought, I had been told, that a funny thing is a thing of goodness. It isn't. Not ever is it funny to the person it happens to, like the sheriff without his pants. The goodness is in the laughing. I grok it as a bravery and a sharing against pain and sorrow and defeat.
But, Mike, it is not a goodness to laugh at people.
No, but I was not laughing at the little monkey. I was laughing at us, people. And suddenly I knew I was people and could not stop laughing. He paused. This is hard to explain because you have never lived as a Martian, for all that I've told you about it. On Mars, there is never anything to laugh at. All the things that are funny to us humans either cannot happen on Mars or are not permitted to happen. Sweetheart, what you call freedom doesn't exist on Mars. Everything is planned by the old ones. Or the things that do happen on Mars, which we laugh at here on Earth, aren't funny because there is no wrongness about them. Death, for example. Death isn't funny. Then why are there so many jokes about death? Jill, with us humans, death is so sad that we must laugh at it. All those religions, they contradict each other on every other point, but each one is filled with ways to help people be brave enough to laugh, even though they knew they are dying. He stopped, and Jill could feel that he had almost gone into a trance. Jill, is it possible that I was searching them the wrong way? Could it be that every one of all religions is true? Huh? How could that be? Mike, if one is true, then the others are wrong. So? Point to the shortest direction around the universe. It doesn't matter where you point. It's the shortest. And you're pointing back at yourself. Well, what does that prove? You taught me the true answer, Mike. Thou art God. And thou art God, my lovely. But that prime fact, which doesn't depend on faith, may mean that all faiths are true.
Well, if they're all true, then right now I want to worship Shiva.
Jill changed the subject with emphatic action. Little pagan, he said softly. They'll run you out of San Francisco.
But we're going to Los Angeles, where it won't be noticed. Oh, thou art Shiva.
Dance, Kali, dance. During the night she woke and saw him standing at the window, looking out over the city.
Trouble, my brother?
He turned. There's no need for them to be so unhappy.
Darling, darling, I had better take you home. The city is not good for you.
that I would still know it. Pain and sickness and hunger and fighting. There's no need for any of it. It's as foolish as those little monkeys.
Yes, darling, but it's not your fault.
Ah, but it is.
Well, that way, yes. But it's not just this one city. It's 5 billion people and more. You can't help 5 billion people.
I wonder.
He came over and sat by her.
I grok them now. I can talk to them, Jill. I could set up our act and make the Marks laugh every minute, I'm certain.
Then why not do it? Patty would be pleased, and so would I. I liked being with it, and now that we've shared water with Patty, it would be like being home. He didn't answer.
Jill felt his mind and knew that he was contemplating, trying to grok.
She waited.
Jill, what do I have to do to be ordained?
Part 4. His Scandalous Career. Chapter 30. The first mixed load of colonists reached Mars. 6 of 17 survivors of 23 originals returned to Earth. Prospective colonists trained in Peru at 16,000 feet. The president of Argentina moved one night to Montevideo, taking 2 suitcases. The new presidente started an extradition process before the High Court to yank him back, or at least the suitcases. Last rites for Alice Douglas were held privately in the National Cathedral with 2,000 attending. Commentators praised the fortitude with which the Secretary General took his bereavement. A 3-year-old named Inflation, carrying 126 pounds, won the Kentucky Derby, paying 54 for one. 2 guests of the Colony Air Hotel, Louisville, discorporated, one voluntarily, one by heart failure. A bootleg edition of the unauthorized biography, The Devil and Reverend Foster, appeared throughout the United States, and by nightfall every copy was burned and plates destroyed, along with damage to chattels and real estate, plus mayhem, maiming, and simple assault. The British Museum was rumored to possess a copy of the first edition, untrue, and also the Vatican Library, true, but available only to church scholars. In the Tennessee legislature, a bill was introduced to make pi equal to 3. It was reported out by the Committee on Public Education and Morals, passed without objection by the lower house, and died in the upper house. An interchurch fundamentalist group opened offices in Van Buren, Arkansas, to solicit funds to send missionaries to the Martians. Dr. Jubal Harshaw made a donation, but sent it in the name, and with the address of the editor of The New Humanist, rabid atheist, and his close friend. Otherwise, Jubal had little to cheer him. Too much news about Mike. He treasured the visits home of Jill and Mike, and was most interested in Mike's progress, especially after Mike developed a sense of humor. But they seldom came home now, and Jubal did not relish the latest developments. It had not troubled Jubal when Mike was run out of Union Theological Seminary, pursued by a pack of enraged theologians, some of whom were angry because they believed in God and others because they did not, but unanimous in detesting the man from Mars. Jubal reckoned anything that happened to a theologian short of breaking him on the wheel as no more than meat, and the experience was good for the boy. He'd know better next time. Nor had he been troubled when Mike, with the help of Douglas, enlisted under an assumed name in the Federation Armed Forces. He had been sure that no sergeant could cause Mike permanent distress, and Jubal was not troubled by what might happen to Federation troops. An unreconciled old reactionary, Jubal had burned his honorable discharge and all that went with it the day the United States ceased having its own forces. Jubal was surprised at how little shambles Mike created as Private Jones, and how long he lasted, almost 3 weeks. Mike crowned his military career by grabbing the question period following a lecture to preach the uselessness of force, with comments on the desirability of reducing surplus population through cannibalism, then offered himself as a test animal for any weapon of any nature to prove that force was not only unnecessary, but impossible when attempted against a self-disciplined person. They did not take his offer. They kicked him out. Douglas allowed Jubal to see a super-secret, eyes-only, numbered 1 of 3 report, after cautioning Jubal that no one, not even the Supreme Chief of Staff, knew that Private Jones was the man from Mars. Jubal scanned the exhibits, mostly conflicting reports as to what happened when Jones had been trained in the uses of weapons. The surprising thing to Jubal was that some witnesses had the courage to state under oath that they had seen weapons disappear. The last paragraph Jubal read carefully. Conclusion. Subject man is a natural hypnotist and could conceivably be useful in intelligence, but he is unfitted for any combat branch. However, his low intelligence quotient, moron, his extremely low general classification score, and his paranoid tendencies, delusions of grandeur, make it inadvisable to exploit his idiot savant talent. Recommendation, discharge, inaptitude. No pension credit, no benefits. Mike had managed to have fun. At parade on his last day, while Mike's platoon was passing in review, the commanding general and his staff were buried hip-deep in a bucolic end product, symbolic to all soldiers, but no longer common on parade grounds. This deposit vanished, leaving nothing but an odor and a belief in mass hypnosis. Jubal decided that Mike had atrocious taste in practical jokes. Then he recalled an incident in medical school involving a cadaver and the dean. Jubal had worn rubber gloves, and a good thing, too. Jubal enjoyed Mike's inglorious military career because Jill spent the time at home. When Mike came home after it was over, he hadn't seemed hurt by it. He boasted to Jubal that he had obeyed Jill's wishes and hadn't disappeared anybody, merely a few dead things. Although, as Mike grokked it, there had been times when Earth could have been made a better place if Jill didn't have this weakness. Jubal didn't argue. He had a lengthy better dead list himself. Mike's unique ways of growing up were all right. Mike was unique. But this last thing. The Reverend Dr. Valentine M. Smith, ABDD, PhD, founder and pastor of the Church of All Worlds, Incorporated. Gad, it was bad enough that the boy decided to be a holy Joe instead of leaving other people's souls alone as a gentleman should. But these diploma mill degrees, Jubal wanted to throw up. The worst was that Mike claimed that he had hatched the idea from something Jubal had said about what a church was and what it could do. Jubal admitted that it was something he could have said, although he did not recall it. Mike had been cagey about the operation. Some months of residence at a very small, very poor sectarian college, a bachelor's degree awarded by examination, a call to their ministry, followed by ordination in this recognized, though flat-headed sect, a doctor's dissertation on comparative religion, which was a marvel of scholarship while ducking any conclusions, the award of the earned doctorate coinciding with an endowment, anonymous to this very hungry school, the second doctorate, honorary, for contributions to interplanetary knowledge from a university that should have known better, when Mike let it be known that such was his price for appearing at a conference on solar system studies. The man from Mars had turned down everybody from Caltech to Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in the past. Harvard could not resist the bait. Well, they were as crimson as their banner now, Jubal thought cynically. Mike put in a few weeks as assistant chaplain at his church mouse alma mater, then broke with the sect in a schism and founded his own church. Completely kosher, legally airtight, as venerable in precedent as Martin Luther, and as nauseating as last week's garbage. Jubal was called out of his sour daydream by Miriam.
Boss, company.
Jubal looked up to see a car about to land.
Larry, fetch my shotgun. I swore I would shoot the next dolt who landed on the rose bushes.
He's landing on the grass, boss.
Tell him to try again. We'll get him on the next pass.
Looks like Ben Caxton.
So it is. Hi, Ben. What'll you drink?
Nothing, you professional bad influence. Need to talk to you, Jubal.
You're doing it. Dorcas, fetch Ben a glass of warm milk. He's sick.
Without much soda, amended Ben, and milk the bottle with the three dimples. Private talk, Jubal.
All right, up to my study. Although, if you can keep anything from the kids around here, let me in on your method.
After Ben finished greeting properly, and unsanitarily in three cases, members of the family, they moseyed upstairs. Ben said,
"What the deuce? Am I lost?"
"Oh, you haven't seen the new wing. Two bedrooms and another bath downstairs. And up here, my gallery.
Enough statues to fill a graveyard."
"Please, Ben, statues are dead politicians. This is sculpture. Please speak in a reverent tone, lest I become violent."
Here are replicas of some of the greatest sculpture this naughty globe has produced.
Well, that hideous thing I've seen before. But when did you acquire the rest of this ballast?